Vítáme vás u dalšího dílu Nového světa. Jsem tu já a se mnou je tu jenom jeden profesor, a to Miroslav Bárta. Ahoj, Mirku.
Ahoj, dobrý den.
A my jsme si, jak už můžete vidět, pozvali do Nového světa místo Martina, který o tom ale ví. On nemohl, jinak by přišel taky. Pozvali jsme si Elizabeth Bro, která napsala knihu, kterou vydáváme v rámci, je to první kniha edice Nový svět, s bohem globalizace. Určitě jste o ní slyšeli, viděli jste ji na sítích, týká se jak jinak než globalizace. Elizabeth dneska přijela do Prahy, skutečně z letiště, tak já ji tady přivítám. Hi Elizabeth, it's good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
So how do you like it? You are like 1 hour in Prague?
A bit more than that, and I like it even more than I liked it last time, which was a lot. What a development this city has gone through over the past 3.5 decades. I haven't been here every year for the past 3.5 decades, but over the years, and it's incredible to see. And it's, I think, thanks to people like you who keep innovating, keep doing new things. I see new things every time.
Really?
I do.
Just don't overdo it, okay?
Next time I will go and see that the parts are not so good.
Be more critical. We are happy to be at that.
Yeah. We always say that we are actually Czech Republic is standing still. It doesn't move anywhere.
Okay. Standing still, as in being stagnant?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I will tell you when I'm next back whether I see anything that wasn't there the time before that. But I can see what you mean. If you have been through a period or years of incredible growth and change, and then it obviously begins to plateau at some point, whether for reasons of political aptitude or ineptitude or just because things have come to a natural plateau. But yeah, I can see that happening. And so you're saying this is where the Czech Republic is at the moment.
You are a former journalist.
Yes, I am.
Yes. Now you are with the famous think tank Atlantic Council, just for the beginning. And I've made an interview last week with one of our EU office members. And he said that Europe is changing pretty fast and there is no EU engine consists from Germany and France anymore. There is a new EG engine consists from France and Central Europe. I think it's not true, but he said that. Do you believe there's something?
So he was saying that the new engine is, yes, France and Central Europe?
Yes.
Hmm. I don't believe so. He was clearly referring to Ukraine, where President Macron has taken a more activist position, let's say, than Olaf Scholz in Germany, and indeed the whole German government. But that's just one issue. And if you look at the EU, the incredible thing about the EU, as we all know, is that it covers basically every area of life except defense. And there, France and Germany are still the engine. But I think what's interesting. Well, two things have happened recently. One is Brexit, which essentially led to the pragmatic wing being weakened because the UK left and its fellow pragmatic countries in Northern Europe then didn't have a larger country around which to coalesce. But then more recently, we have seen another development, which is more disharmony or a new disharmony between France and Germany about issues of the day, especially Ukraine. And throughout the history of the European Union, France and Germany have been twins, essentially. They have been so close. And now it's interesting and I think a little bit concerning to see them openly disagree, even if it's, I shouldn't say just Ukraine, but Ukraine is one of many issues, and that is the issue on which they have shown disagreement. But what does that mean, that the fact that they are willing to carry out this disagreement in public?
Okay, so you don't believe that there will be a new engine, EU engine, in the near future. So there still will be this Franco-German pact.
There will be, but I think we may see a rival emerge, which is Poland under its new government wanting to have a stronger role, have a stronger say within the European Union. And it has tried, as you know, for years to build a group around itself. And now it's back with this new government that whose prime minister feels comfortable around EU issues and EU settings. And I wonder, it would be fascinating to watch whether Poland will be able to bring countries around it. It's economically stronger than it was clearly 20 years ago. It's also more ambitious and has the desire to play a larger role, but with other countries support that ambition and be the junior partners in this prospective alliance to rival France and Germany.
Well, if nothing else, Poland offers a huge market. That's for sure. That's one thing. And maybe with this engine, it was meant precisely what you referred to. It's France, Germany, and probably, hopefully, Poland. So these three states should be now behind upcoming changes. But looking at the European engine from a different perspective, we have upcoming EU elections. What would be your take on this? Do you think that they will bring in a new swing in the politics or new perspectives on how to approach the Green Deal and problems that are coming upon our heads from all different sides of the world?
The interesting thing about European elections, like midterms in America and local elections in most countries, is that they give, because they're considered less important than national parliamentary elections and in the US, the presidential election years, they give people the opportunity to voice dissatisfaction or unhappiness with whatever is the issue or the whatever the traditional parties are doing. So, and it has been the case for a long time that people have voted differently in the European elections, often have voted differently in the European elections compared to elections at home, simply because it was an opportunity to voice dissatisfaction with existing
political... A small percentage of the population as well.
Yes, exactly. So you have a disproportionate outcome in the European elections because it is the case that not as many people vote there as in national elections. So that's what makes them so unpredictable. Will people become motivated to go to the polls and vote in the European elections because they want to send a signal to the so-called establishment parties? Or will they vote for another reason? Will they vote in larger numbers? But it is the case that the European elections, just like the American midterms, are traditionally an opportunity for people to send a signal to whoever is in charge that, oh, don't take us for granted.
Beautifully expressed, politically correct. But you've been insider for years, right? So my question would be, you personally, do you hope for or are you afraid of some major changes following the EU elections as an insider, as a person, you know, working in the Western part of Europe? Just your personal take. There's nothing else.
Yeah. I'll tell you what I am worried about. It's that so many people here in Europe, in the European Union, take democracy for granted and think that they can just keep throwing mud at it, can keep disrespecting it, can keep voting for reasons other than wanting the best party to be elected. And we are so lucky to have democracy. And we see in lots of other countries around the world, you know, people are still paying a very significant price if they advocate for democracy. We are seeing it even in Russia, which we thought years ago was on the road to democracy, to some sort of functioning democracy. Now, democracy is very much under threat in Russia. And if you want such a thing as free elections, you, well,
it's a joke.
Well, you will either be in prison or you will have to go abroad or worse things may happen to you. And this is what I'm worried about, that we take it for granted because we have had, in some cases, many decades of freedom and democracy, and in some cases, 3.5 decades, but nevertheless, it's a long time. And we take it for granted. But the problem is, if enough people throw mud at various democratic institutions and don't realize what a precious construct democracy is, then it will deteriorate. And we won't, it's like good health. You don't appreciate it until you no longer have it. And I worry that's where we may end up.
We can see the rising of a lot of populist parties among EU member states. Do you see this is the main threat? Or is it Russia? Or is it something else?
The main threat is that we don't appreciate what we've got and we take it for granted. And it's perhaps understandable that we take it for granted, because if you are 35 years old today, you will have known nothing but incredible economic growth, cheaper consumer goods, functioning democracy, and most of all, peace. And so why should you be grateful? That is the only world you know. But if we don't realize how rare it is to have such a thing, and taking for granted or disrespecting it or criticizing or attacking it, then we make it much easier for Russia, for China, for others to weaken our countries, which is why many among us are essentially unwittingly amplifying, helping Russia in its efforts to weaken our countries. And that's really dangerous. One example, remember Kate Middleton. She was away from the public eye for a few weeks because she had abdominal surgery. And people, apparently with nothing better to do, kept entertaining themselves on social media, spreading, coming up with all kinds of conspiracy theories about what was wrong with Kate.
And she was actually murdered by the royal family. This was one of the conspiracies.
Really? That sort of thing. And then when researchers, after she then a few weeks later made her statement saying she had cancer, disinformation researchers looked at the traffic that had been generated around all these conspiracy theories and found that Russia had actually been very active spreading them. So these people who thought they were just entertaining themselves on social media had actually helped Russia in its incessant efforts to weaken our countries by spreading falsehoods, uncertainty, criticism, unfair criticism, unfounded criticism of various institutions. And I think that should give people pause, and they should stop to reflect on the fact, or should stop to think about, what is it? What is the effect of me doing something that I consider just fun or entertaining? What is the effect of that? It's not just about me. It's actually, I have to think about the effect of what I do on wider society. And I'm sorry if it, you know, I don't want to sound like some sort of killjoy, like, oh, you shouldn't have fun on social media. But actually, Russia is on social media. Various Russian actors are on social media all the time. Chinese actors as well, actors from other hostile countries. And it would be, I think, a good thing if we didn't help them more than they deserve to be helped, which is not to be helped at all.
Would you both agree if I said that the cause, at least partial cause for all this you just referred to, would be that we've been drowning in opulence in entertainment since several decades? That's one thing. And second thing that is linked to the issue we just started. If you look all over the world, democratic or democratically run states are becoming less and less in numbers. So what do you see, I mean, both of you, the main reasons behind this, you know, I would say at least mid-range, even long trend? Is it the lack of leadership? Is it lack of proper education so that people can't use democracy properly.
Maybe lack of values.
Lack of values, lack of visions. I mean, all these symbolical values, because Western world is loves to run on numbers. And isn't it this a way to nowhere? Maybe?
It is one of those fundamental questions. So we can build societies, and it takes a lot of effort, a lot of vision. But what happens when you have built everything that you set out to build, and then you have pretty much perfectly functioning institutions, economies, social systems, and so forth, then what do you do after that? And I think that's why people turn to things that are just very different, because they need something other than being part of this process of building wealth. They're looking for something different. And for better or worse, religion is just not as strong in Western societies as it used to be. So if you don't have religion to turn to, what do you turn to? Well, you can turn to crazy conspiracy theories. Mm. You can marathon on the opposite end. Marathon is a huge thing, and not because everybody has discovered they like to run, but because it's a sort of community. Or on the conspiracy side of that wide range of alternative ways of setting your life up, you have QAnon. Remember, QAnon took off from nothing, and I think it was because it gave people some sort of explanation about how society worked and their role in it. So we had that, and we had the anti-vaxxer movement, and we'll no doubt have many more of these movements. And then, as I said, all the way over to marathon, which is definitely not a conspiracy theory. It's just a way of doing something, aiming for something, working towards something, having community, yoga, the same thing. And so these things keep popping up. And what will be the next thing, I wonder?
So there is this joke about the Roman Empire, that every man thinks about the Roman Empire and decline of Roman Empire at least once a day. So do you see any similarities?
Do you think it's inevitable that we'll start thinking about the decline of the Western world at least once a day? There probably are similarities, but let's not make it a self-fulfilling prophecy by thinking too much about it. Let's help keep our Western world, which is really such an incredible privilege to live in the Western world, in enormous material comfort, in freedom, prosperity, peace, all of that. So let's not talk too much about the inevitable decline of the Western world. But I do agree that every construct, nation construct, or indeed perhaps a construct of many nations together, will reach a plateau when everything that we set out to build has been built, and then when we can't think of what to do next, then that's, I think, when the decay starts happening.
It will be AI, the next thing.
Yes. An adversary as powerful as, or even more powerful than, the Russia and China.
When you compare state of democracy in Europe or in the European states and in the United States, who is doing better or worse?
It is the case that societal trends usually start in the United States and then come to us in Europe in a diluted form, and which is a long way of answering your question. I think America is doing worse, and the reason it's doing worse is that the societal fragmentation and hostility between people has reached a really frightening level. I first moved to the US in the mid-90s, and I'm very much European, but I enjoyed living there because people were friendly. I mean, we all know that Americans are friendly, and what I particularly liked was that they sort of got along among themselves with people who were like them and were not like them or didn't share their political opinions. In fact, people didn't talk very much about their political opinions. But then I think what we have seen since then is the result of what Robert Putnam called Bowling Alone, and that was a book that he published in 1999 documenting the decline in civic engagement in America. And back in 1999, it was interesting. Oh, so people aren't as engaged in bowling clubs, in choirs, in churches, in various charitable undertakings as they used to be. That was interesting. Well, now we are seeing the result of that. If they don't interact with people from across society as much as they used to. So you and I, if we were Americans back in the 50s, we would have bowled together, even though you may have had completely different political opinions. You may have been in a completely different profession, but we would have bowled together. And as a result, you know, we would have interacted and had that basis on which to coexist. But if you don't have that basis, first of all, you don't interact. And second of all, because you don't spend as much time in it being civically engaged, you have a lot more time to spend reading about Kate Middleton or any other issue of the day. And these issues are increasingly political. So you become very political as a person. And it's all about national issues. It's not so much about local issues, because local newspapers have died in alarming numbers. And that's what I worry about. If the only basis or the most important basis on which people interact with one another is politics, then you will get social fragmentation, then you will get hostility, and then you will get a dysfunctioning political system, which is what I think is happening in America. And I hope we don't get that far here in Europe.
The essential idea of your book is that the world now turned towards deglobalization. Do you think it's a long-term trend, or is it just a swing of the pendulum for several reasons, one of them being that the current setup of how we run the world globally, and I'm talking about United Nations, the Security Council that is completely blocked, has expired, that we need a major change in the global affairs. We have to restructure the United Nations, the Security Council, etc. Because as a consequence, what you can see, for instance, is that countries that have not very much in common, such as Brazil, India, South Africa, are getting together in one organization called BRIC, because simply they have no other option. But this way is quite illogical for them, politically, economically, culturally, etc., etc., you name it. So can we afford to go deglobal? Can we really afford it? Because, I mean, most of the problems we've been facing are global. I mean, it's CO2, it's climate change, it's fighting poverty, it's dealing with epidemic diseases, etc., etc.
So there are two things. The first is that globalization was built on the idea that it's all about economics. So if we trade more with one another, then first of all, it's so efficient, and that's why we have this prosperity, especially in the developed world, but also in some other countries, because it is incredibly efficient to build an economy this way, where you don't have to manufacture in lots of different places and essentially replicating the effort in lots of different places. You can have incredible efficiency by manufacturing primarily in one place, and that could be China or indeed another country, and you have global shipping that transports the things around back and forth between various countries and then on to where they need to go. It's so efficient. But what we've discovered is that it's not all about economics. Countries are not just economical, are not just economic creatures, just as people are not just economic creatures. And I think what we've discovered is that some countries are their top priority is not to increase trade. Their top priority may be something else altogether. For Russia, the top priority was clearly to get parts of Ukraine. So Putin was willing to sacrifice Russia's part in the globalized economy in order to for him to get parts of Ukraine, or indeed all of Ukraine. And they may seem totally illogical to us, but for him, that's what he wanted to do. Similarly, for Xi Jinping, his priority is, as we have now found out, is not to increase prosperity in China at all costs. It's to remain in power. So he's willing to crack down on the private sector in China, Western companies, but also Chinese companies, which is why Jack Ma, the most famous Chinese entrepreneur there is, has essentially got into trouble with the authorities through no fault of his own. His fault was that he had become too powerful. So it's not just about economics. And that's what we have seen with citizens all over the West as well, who have benefited so massively from globalization. They are now voicing their disaffection with globalization and the global elite, the faraway elite. And you can say, well, that is so ungrateful. These faraway elites have created this incredible prosperity where that means that any teenager today can have a smartphone. That is extraordinary. But people are not just economic creatures. And I think that is the bottom line. And then, so that's one side, or one aspect. The second aspect is that nation states can't get along forever. The EU is an anomaly because we have decades, many decades now, of EU countries getting along, but that is the huge exception. We thought we could get along with China, with Russia, and so forth, and it turns out that yes, we can get along for a while, and then both sides realize that, oh, you know, it's not really working very well. They are not doing what they said they were going to do. They are not playing by the rules. And I'm sure China and Russia would have a massive catalog of complaints against us. So, you know, we are arrogant. We're trying to intervene in their countries and so forth. So countries won't get along forever. And then on top of that, you have the decline of the institutions the world built up after the end of World War II. And it also has to do with the fact that really it was Western countries that were the primary driver behind that. And other countries are resenting it, which is why we're seeing India demanding a permanent seat in the UN Security Council. So the point is, I think we'll have the pendulum will swing towards less global cooperation, unfortunately, at a very inopportune moment. But that's the way it's swinging. And so we'll have less cooperation. We'll have within trade, we'll have more regional focus. And we have to get as many countries as we can to be part of the Western grouping. But then I think we'll have a new era of globalization that may be a bit more pragmatic than this round, which was really had a lot of idealism in it. And I think actually the next round will be quite good. And it will include climate change as one of its pillars that we have to work on together.
You remind me, when I was living in the States almost 20 years ago in Philly, I always purchased a weekend edition of New York Times. This is the famous column by Tom Friedman, the author of the famous, you know, Lexus and the Olive Tree. Yeah. Thank you for being late. And now I would be really, have you managed to talk to him recently? Because, I mean, all his major work dedicated to globalization burns in flames.
Yes, and yes.
So do you know his take on this now? Because I checked recently on Amazon and there is no new book by him.
No.
I know any recent book, but it would be very...
He's quite depressed. He's not able to write.
Very interesting to hear also from him what he thinks about the, you know, the latest happenings over the last 4 or 5 years.
Yes, I think we'll wait a long time for that book. it may be too depressing for him to write it. So we may never see it. And I think who am I to criticize Tom Friedman? He he is a very respected, highly respected writer. But what he did when he wrote those books was he went around to see the winners of globalization, and he didn't go to.
That's a nice point. Yes.
Yeah, he didn't go to the Rust Belt. He didn't go to parts of India that didn't have the call centers that made lots of money where English speaking people could work. So of course it looked like this is a new world where you can be anywhere. You can be anyone, you are part of it. And it looks like a whole world when you're inside that world and you forget, oh, there's a whole other world outside.
What a surprise. Huh?
Yeah.
Is there any tipping point or break point where this so-called decline of globalization has started?
One interesting aspect, or one key moment, was COVID, and it was a key moment for so many different reasons. First of all, because COVID spread so quickly, because we are a globalized world. Remember, people brought COVID from Wuhan to Italy because they kept going back and forth for reasons of business. And so that's how we got COVID in Europe. And it doesn't matter where COVID originated. The point is that it went from Wuhan to Italy, and then there was no hope for us in Europe to be able to contain it. And similarly, it went to other countries. And that was part of the globalized world. If this had happened before globalization, the spread would have been much slower, and we would have had a much better chance of containing it. The second thing, though, that happened was that the Chinese authorities were not transparent about the fact that the virus was spreading. And again, it doesn't matter where it originated. The point is that they were embarrassed that it was spreading and didn't want to tell the world. And then it spread and killed, as we now know, millions of people around the world, which means that everybody around the world, except I think North Korea. Well, it did actually spread to North Korea as well in the end. Yes. Everybody in the world was affected by this. And then we saw people in the Western world, and indeed in other countries, started saying, well, hang on, what is this Chinese government that is so non-transparent, and as a result causes incredible harm and pain to my family? And we saw in opinion polls in the West, we saw the share or the percentage of people who said they distrusted Xi Jinping or the Chinese government. Those figures skyrocketed. And I think before COVID, most people hadn't really been paying attention to, do I trust Xi Jinping and the Chinese government, or do I not trust them? But they were just there. But when COVID hit, that's when those figures started skyrocketing. And the third thing, of course, was that companies and politicians and ordinary citizens alike discovered that, oh, we are massively dependent on China for our supply chains. Remember, PPE couldn't be had because we didn't make PPE ourselves anymore in our countries. And China didn't want to increase production. So we had incredible shortages of PPE for a while. Then it sorted itself out. But that was another wake-up call for companies and indeed everybody else, and so we discovered really the drawback or the disadvantages of a globalized economy. And I should add, for companies, it didn't just stop with PPE. They've for many months until very recently they've had to contend with disruption and shortages in delivery, because China had the zero COVID policy that meant they shut down any given workplace factory as soon as there was one COVID case. Well, what does that mean if you're a Western manufacturer that depends on either has manufacturing in China and or has Chinese suppliers? That is a massive inconvenience.
It looks like that China is actually the biggest loser of this globalization decline.
You could say it's a loser. You could also say it has reached an incredible level of prosperity, and that's what the Chinese government set out to do. It doesn't need any higher levels of material prosperity. And now you can say what the Chinese government needs to do under the leadership of Xi Jinping is to remain in power, because he is not going to want to step down, and nor is the rest of the government. So I think their priority is to remain in power, not to increase prosperity. And what China has gone through in the past, well, since it started opening up in the 80s, is extraordinary, right? I mean, they have essentially an economy very similar to ours. Their companies, in many cases, are as sophisticated as ours. They can produce anything that we can produce. That goes far beyond manufacturing. Their financial institutions, banks, investment banks, and so forth, are just as good as ours. So they don't need to be part of this globalized economy anymore in order to propel themselves forward. And you can say, well, things will keep developing, and you have to trade in order to increase prosperity. Well, I think the challenge, and this comes back to what we were discussing earlier about what do you do when you've achieved everything. I think Xi Jinping wouldn't want to reach a stage where the population of China is so prosperous and has everything, and then start saying, well, hang on, we want democracy. So that's why he has to focus so much on making sure that his government, his regime has a strong hold on power.
And now for something completely different, as they say in Britain. Leadership. One thing is, do you think we need leadership? Because, you know, there has been a philosophy of new leadership that basically the modern world of the 21st century doesn't need it at all. And should you say, yes, we do need leadership, do you personally see around you, Western Europe or the US or the world in general, example of inspirative leadership? Would you be, and if you see them, would you be willing to share some names
yes.
with us? Because I have a problem. If they ask me, for instance, do you see a leadership in your country? I say, don't let me refrain from my answer. So leadership, yes or no? And if you see it around you.
Yeah. So I do see it. There are two politicians who come to mind who are not prime ministers, but are very good.
It doesn't have to be political. Yeah. It's going to be a scientist person like you. I see a leadership around me now.
Thank you. Well, I was soliciting that comment.
You should become a politician.
But there are two elected politicians who I think are very good at one thing in particular, which is to have honest and transparent communication with the public. And that's Robert Habeck in Germany and Carl-Oskar Bohlin in Sweden. So Habeck in Germany, I think everybody knows who he is. Carl-Oskar Bohlin in Sweden is less well known. He's Minister of Civil Defense, mm-hmm. which means that he looks after everything in the Ministry of Defense that doesn't have to do with the armed forces. And that's a new role that the new Swedish government has created, and he has it. And he and Habeck alike are so good at communicating with the public about what it is that needs attention, the problems that need solving in their respective countries. And I think that is the sort of leadership that is very helpful in democracies like ours, so we don't pretend everything is perfect. And I think people want to understand what is it that's going wrong, what is it where I can make a contribution to fixing whatever it is that's going wrong. And I have to say, I'm often reminded of Václav Havel's essay about the falling window ledge in the street here in Prague. And he describes in this essay that a window ledge fell down in the street, this was in the 70s, and killed a woman. And the newspapers, the government newspapers, started then writing stories about how good it is that Czechoslovakia had the appropriate systems to deal with this, and how fantastic it was that there are so many solutions to everything. And he calls this essay on evasive thinking, because it, they didn't want to address the problem, which was clearly poor housing construction, and instead focused on the fact that everything had gone well in the end, and the window ledge had been reattached and so forth. And I think there is a lot of evasive thinking happening simply because it's more comfortable to talk about smaller problems, about more marginal problems or issues that you can solve, rather than saying, well, hang on, this is the fundamental issue that faces our country. I'll just put it to you, and I invite you to be part of the solution. I don't have the solution, but here is the problem. And it is uncomfortable for a politician to do that, because I think most of us voters expect answers from politicians, and we want them to figure out what it is that needs to be done. And ideally, the government should do it so that we don't need to do it. But what if more politicians started doing what Habeck and Bolin are doing and say, well, This is the problem. Let's try to fix it together. And I'm not trying to be Pollyanna-ish by suggesting that, oh, you know, then we'll all come together and as a community. No, but at least we would, I think, feel that we are empowered to feel empowered to think about what's not going right and also what can be done about it.
You didn't mention Macron.
I didn't.
Why?
Or somebody from Great Britain.
Somebody from Great Britain.
It's a mess.
We are teasing you, sorry. You don't have to.
Somebody from Great Britain. Well, I think in order to be a serious leader, you also have to be, to be a credible leader, with leadership that is worth respect, you also have to be a serious leader. You can say Boris Johnson is a leader because he manages to get people excited. Well, he's also a deeply dishonest leader because he picks issues on the basis of what gets him attention, and he doesn't propose serious solutions. He's essentially, I shouldn't discredit journalists, but he's essentially a newspaper columnist, and he thinks along the lines of what will get him attention and what will sound good.
So at the same time, old money. I mean, traditional background, and
yes,
maybe this conflict led him to where he ended up.
Yes, but all of that is to say that I don't think that's an example for anybody to strive to repeat. Macron is interesting. He is essentially, just as Boris Johnson is a newspaper man, Macron is essentially a think tanker who happens to be president. He's very good at being president, but his mentality is to be a think tanker, to come up with new ideas. Unfortunately, I think he comes up with more ideas than he can implement. And so he presents them, and then he seems to forget about them, or at the very least, they are not implemented. But he, like democracy itself, we are lucky to have him, and we'll miss him when he is gone, because the alternatives in France don't look very good. And in fact, France could get he could be succeeded by president by somebody who doesn't actually believe that strongly in democracy. So we are lucky to have him, and we are lucky to have such people in political office. And I worry that with the constant attacks on democracy itself, we'll get more people, fewer people who are serious about it and who are serious about solutions, and we'll get more imposters and people who have incredibly thick skin but are not acting in good faith and are not going to be beneficial to our democracies because they actually don't believe in democracy that much themselves.
Well, this reminds me of a British habit. If you say about somebody's talk, like Miroslav, your talk was really interesting, it's one of the worst things you can experience, because if a British comes to you saying, very interesting, you lost it.
Yep.
So I noticed your connection of interesting Macron. Fair enough. There is one thing that is a very close to me personally, and that's the 4,200 kilometers long border of two huge countries, Russia being still an imperium and China being still an imperium. They closed I wouldn't say a friendship, but cooperation. It's an ad hoc cooperation because they never really cooperated on sincere terms. And my experience with different civilizations is that if you have a bordering zone of such a two powerful states that can influence world far behind their borders without using armies, would you be afraid? Because that's my feeling, that this might become one of the critical zones in the very near future, because China is recently on social networks in China, there has been postings referring to Vladivostok and, you know, Eastern Siberia, saying we still have a, you know, formal arrangement with the Russia, that this is Russia's territory, but historically it's the empire of the center. It's our land. And I think this ad hoc friendship can't last very long. Well, when Ukraine gets sorted out in one or another way, I think this border may be really one of the huge conflict zones in the world in the very near future. Do you think I'm mistaken?
I think China has more urgent priorities than taking land from Russia. And it is the case that the world as it is at the moment is very advantageous for China. It's not that long ago that China was definitely the Soviet Union's very junior partner. Now it's the case that Russia is very definitely China's very junior partner. So the balance of power has shifted massively in favor of China. And indeed, Russia would be lost without China's support because it's shut out of the globalized economy. It works really well for China. And China has other priorities. And as you know, Xi Jinping keeps talking about Taiwan. It would be unwise to bet on a prospective invasion of Taiwan, but that is clearly much more in Xi Jinping's mind than is Russia. And in fact, it serves China quite well to have Russia in this weakened position where Russia would never dare to object to anything that China does, simply because it doesn't really have any other friends anymore.
But as far as I can remember, China has never fought a war beyond the borders. Yeah. Do you think they would, I mean, psychologically, they are ready in their mental setup to say, okay, we are going to attack Taiwan, though they consider it to be not a foreign country.
Yeah.
They would fight the war on their own territory. But necessarily, to start a war from China's side means to open up the country. And if there is something in Chinese history that is completely foreign to them, that's opening up the country. That's why they burned the ships in the 16th century, because they were simply not willing to open up.
Yeah.
And what they do now, that's a certain reaction to being forced to open up, because this is something that goes against the very essence of their civilization.
It is interesting to think about. I shouldn't say interesting, since you just pointed out the meaning. You just made a very interesting comment, so I will refrain from using the word interesting. It is fascinating to look at Chinese history and the extent to which it may motivate and inform decisions or positions by leaders of today. It seems to be the case that authoritarian leaders in particular develop obsessions with certain issues, even though it doesn't seem logical. And in the case of Putin, it was Ukraine. And in the case of Xi Jinping, it seems to be Taiwan, even though you would say, well, hang on, why does harming Taiwan make any sense from a Chinese perspective? It's not that big, and you would get into trouble with really the most a large chunk of the world, and you would definitely harm your remaining trading ties with the Western world. But I think actually, since he's so obsessed with Taiwan, he may try measures short of war, because you can, he can, and we saw a good example of what China is willing to do when President Tsai of Taiwan went to California to visit then Speaker McCarthy of the U.S. House of Representatives. So if you're China, you consider that a very provocative act. And so how do you respond where people said, oh, now they're going to attack Taiwan? I never thought they would, because if you do that, then the die is really cast. And instead, what they did was first they conducted this military exercise, essentially playing out the invasion or attack of Taiwan. But they also did another thing that was really clever, which was that they sent out what they called an inspection flotilla to the Taiwan Strait. And even though the Taiwan Strait has a Chinese side and a Taiwanese side with a median line in the middle, but China, of course, doesn't recognize the median line. The other countries do, and most especially Taiwan does. But they sent out this inspection flotilla with a mission of inspecting shipping across the Taiwan Strait. And that's a major shipping thoroughfare. So if you start inspecting that, not only is it a huge provocation vis-a-vis Taiwan, to which they would have to respond, it's also extremely disruptive to global shipping, and global shipping and manufacturers will then say, well, hang on, it's not safe to travel through the Taiwan Strait anymore. We won't call on Taiwan's key ports anymore because they are on the western side of the island sort of facing that strait. And so there are things like that that you can do. Who is going to respond to an inspection flotilla? Nobody. It's not an act of war, and yet you can cause so much disruption. You can cause the Taiwanese economy to be cut off from incoming and outgoing cargo, and essentially Taiwan would be cut off from the globalized economy if China wanted to conduct such inspection flotillas, or if they wanted to send out dispatch more inspection flotillas.
Thank you.
Maybe the last question. To me, you look like a very quiet, optimistic person. And so maybe we can end it in an optimistic way. Do you see any possibility that the war on Ukraine will end in the near future?
Well, I wanted to end on an optimistic note.
I think there's no way.
You have to give me a different question.
We're not in trouble.
So I don't see that happening. And the only way it would end in the near future would be if Ukraine surrendered. And I don't think we should wish for Ukraine to surrender. Putin is clearly not going to say, well, we had a good run and we got some territory and now we'll pull back and apologize and beg forgiveness for the inconvenience. That's not going to happen.
They simply sacrificed too much.
Yes. But if so, no, I don't see an imminent end to the Ukraine war. And so every day, that means every day we have to mourn even more Ukrainian civilians who are losing their lives needlessly. This war didn't have to happen. There are wars that I shouldn't say that any war is necessary, but there are wars that come about out of very fundamental reasons. In this case, the war didn't need to happen. It was just a result of, as discussed, Putin's obsession with Ukraine. So we'll have to live with this really tragic situation in our midst here in the middle of Europe for some time to come. But if I can end on an optimistic note, it is that the struggles that globalization are experiencing, and the fact that the world is dividing into two blocks and will possibly have even more blocks. But the point is that we won't be as closely connected or as united as we were even 10 years ago. Actually, that's an unexpected opportunity to have another go at globalization and include the parts that we forgot last time, including most importantly, the need to address climate change. That's something that we can only do together. It was never part of conversations about globalization in the late 80s and early 90s. It was not a concern. Now it's the main concern facing the world. And when we have what I hope will be a second globalization, that will be climate change, and cutting CO2 emissions will be a key pillar of it. And so will the fact that we should be able to trade maybe on a more pragmatic basis, and that will also, I think, be a more successful basis, because we won't go into it with as much optimism, perhaps naivety, as we did last time. And I think that will create a longer lasting run of globalization 2.0. Then we may even have 3.0 when 2.0 fails. But I'm hoping for a good 2.0.
I would maybe add one more optimistic aspect of our meeting here, which lasts more than 50 minutes. I would say that as long there are people like you, thinkers like you, and the books like you, the world gets better and better. So thank you very much for doing it.
Yeah.
Thank
true.
You. Thank
that's
you.
True. Thank you. Hope you have a nice day in Prague.
I will. I won't give any superlative comments now, because I did that right at the beginning, but I will have a nice day in Prague.
Thank you. Thank you. A my vám děkujeme, že nás posloucháte. Nezapomeňte, kniha s Bohem globalizace od Elizabeth Bro už je k mání na shop.datara.cz. Mějte se hezky. Už melu z cesty. Nevadí, mějte se hezky.
Naschledanou.